Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Pope Francis appealed to the United States Wednesday to take urgent action and help slow the pace of climate change because the world is at a critical moment of history.
Accepting the urgency, it seems clear to me also that climate change is a problem we can no longer be left to a future generation.
President Barack Obama warmly welcomed the leader of the Roman Catholic Church to the White House on a beautiful autumn morning in Washington, and he agreed that Americans and people throughout the world have a sacred obligation to protect our planet. The president and the Pope are speaking at an official arrival ceremony celebrating the Pontiff's first visit to the United States. They saluted each other in speeches that were frequently interrupted by applause from 15,000 invited guests on the White House lawn.
You shake our conscience from slumber. You call on us to rejoice in good news and give us confidence that we can come together in humility and service and pursue a world that is more loving, more just, and more free.
Turning to the 78-year-old Pope, the President praised the Pontiff for your humility, your embrace of simplicity, the gentleness of your words, and the generosity of your spirit. Chinese President Xi Jinping is calling for better relations with Washington to help prevent what he called what he said would be disastrous conflict between the two nations as he begins his week-long tour of the United States. The comments came Tuesday during a much anticipated policy speech to business leaders in Seattle. Chinese leader also addressed cyber hacking with President Barack Obama, and he had said that it would figure prominently in their one-on-one talks at the White House. This is VOA News. European Union leaders gathered in Brussels Wednesday for an emergency meeting on the continent's vast migrant crisis, looking to tighten the region's borders while offering new aid to Turkey and other countries hosting refugees from the Syrian conflict. But the EU heads of state remained split on how to cope with the thousands of asylum seekers streaming to Europe, even after their interior ministers adopted a country-by-country quota plan Tuesday to disperse 120,000 migrants throughout the 28-nation bloc. The EU is also proposing to spend $1.9 billion to improve emergency migrant reception centers in Europe. Burkina Faso's interim president, Michel Kafando, says he is back in power exactly 1 week after he was detained by members of the presidential guard who staged a coup. Kafando said Wednesday his government has been restored and he is resuming power this very minute. Earlier, members of the Presidential Guard agreed to return to their barracks in a deal made after the presidents of Senegal, Togo, Benin, and Nigeria traveled to the capital, Ouagadougou, to negotiate. Government troops who had streamed into the capital in opposition of the coup leaders have agreed to retreat to 50 kilometers outside the city. Coup leader General Gilbert Diendéré apologized to the country Tuesday and vowed to hand over power when requested by the leaders' meeting in Ouagadougou. The Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia is calling on Muslims around the world to unite against misguided elements, including extremist groups such as the Islamic State that want to take Islam back to the age of ignorance. Daesh, the Islamic State, is busy trying to destroy the Muslim Ummah, or community, in the name of Islam. Groups like Daesh present incorrect interpretations of Islam, said the Grand Mufti. The chief Saudi cleric delivered the remarks during his annual sermon to more than 2 million Muslims who had converged on the valley of Mount Arafat for a day of prayer Wednesday at the annual Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia. U.S. baseball great Yogi Berra, who won 10 World Series championships as a catcher with the New York Yankees in the 1940s and 50s, and became one of the sport's most beloved figures, has died at the age of 90. Berra joined the Yankees in 1946 and played the entire 19-year career with the legendary franchise, sharing the dugout with other Yankee greats such as Joe DiMaggio and Mickey Mantle, eventually appearing in a total of 14 World Series. Born in St. Louis in 1925, Lawrence Peter Berra earned the nickname Yogi when a friend said that picture of a Hindu holy man sitting with his legs crossed reminded him of Berra sitting on the ground while he waited his turn at bat. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
As the son of an immigrant family, I'm happy to be a guest in this country, which was largely built by such families.
That's Pope Francis addressing a crowd at the White House today. Details coming up. Also in the news, an estimated 2 million Muslim pilgrims from around the world climbed Mount Arafat today, completing the high point of the annual Hajj into Mecca. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, President Obama welcomed Pope Francis to the White House today with a formal outdoor ceremony on the South Lawn. Mr. Obama said the pontiff's message of love and hope has inspired many people across the nation and around the world.
Today we mark many firsts. Your Holiness, you've been celebrated as the first pope from the Americas. This is your first visit to the United States. And you are also the first pontiff to share an encyclical through a Twitter account. Holy Father, your visit not only allows us in some small way to reciprocate the extraordinary hospitality that you extended to me at the Vatican last year, it also reveals how much all Americans, from every background and every faith, value the role that the Catholic Church plays in strengthening America.
The president said the excitement over Pope Francis's visit is due in large part to his unique qualities as a person.
In your humility, your embrace of simplicity, in the gentleness of your words, in the generosity of your spirit, we see a living example of Jesus' teachings, a leader whose moral authority comes not just through words, but also through deeds. You call on all of us, Catholic and non-Catholic alike, to put the least of these at the center of our concerns. You remind us that in the eyes of God, our measure as individuals and our measure as a society is not determined by wealth or power or station or celebrity, but by how well we hew to Scripture's call to lift up the poor and the marginalized. To stand up for justice and against inequality, and to ensure that every human being is able to live in dignity, because we are all made in the image of God.
President Obama says that people are only truly free when they can practice their faith freely.
Here in the United States, we cherish religious liberty. It was the basis for so much of what brought us together. And here in the United States, we cherish our religious liberty, but around the world, at this very moment, children of God, including Christians, are targeted and even killed because of their faith. Believers are prevented from gathering at their places of worship. The faithful are imprisoned, and churches are destroyed. So we stand with you in defense of religious freedom and interfaith dialogue, knowing that people everywhere must be able to live out their faith free from fear and free from intimidation. And Holy Father, you remind us that we have a sacred obligation to protect our planet, God's magnificent gift to us. We support your call to all world leaders to support the communities most vulnerable to changing climate and to come together to preserve our precious world for future generations.
President Obama said the Pope's words and deeds have set a profound moral example. Following the president's remarks, Pope Francis took to the podium and addressed the gathering at the White House. He said that as a son of an immigrant family, he was happy to be in the U.S., which was largely built by such families.
During my visit, I will have the honor of addressing Congress, where I hope, as a brother of this country, to offer words of encouragement to those called to guide the nation's political future in fidelity to its founding principles. I will also travel to Philadelphia for the 8th World Meeting of Families to celebrate and support the institutions of marriage and the family at this critical moment in the history of our civilization.
He said American Catholics are committed to building a society that is tolerant and inclusive and rejects every form of injustice and discrimination. Pope Francis also addressed the issue of climate change.
Mr. President, I find it encouraging that you are proposing an initiative for reducing air pollution. Accepting the urgency, it seems clear to me also that climate change is a problem we can no longer be left to a future generation. When it comes to the care of our common home, we are living at a critical moment of history. We still have time to make the change needed to bring about a sustainable and integral development, for we know that things can change.
Speaking at the White House, Pope Francis called on all Americans to join the efforts to protect vulnerable people around the world. Immigration is a hot topic in the U.S. presidential race, and Pope Francis also says it is an important issue. Now a new report looks at how immigrants and their descendants integrate into U.S. society. While many see improvements in education, income, and language ability over the years, the report says their well-being can actually decline. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
There are 41 million immigrants in the United States today. That's a record high number for the so-called nation of immigrants. And there are more than 37 million children of immigrants who were born in the U.S. and are therefore citizens. Those first and second generations of immigrants account for 25% of the U.S. population. It's estimated that 11.6 million immigrants have not entered the U.S. legally. Most are believed to be from Mexico. Each year, nearly 1 million foreign nationals become legal permanent residents of the country, obtaining what's known as a green card. The new study, commissioned by the Department of Homeland Security and several foundations, reveals how immigrants fare in the United States over several generations. Harvard sociology professor Mary Waters is chair of the committee that conducted the study and author of the report. She says there had not been a report by the National Academy of Sciences on immigration since the mid-1990s.
In the 20 years since then, the question was, how have things changed and how are immigrants who have been increasing over time integrating into American life?
She says the U.S. has a long history of accepting immigrants and immigrants adopting American ways.
In almost all ways, immigrants are becoming more like native-born Americans as they integrate, as they live here and form families and work and go to school. And that happens over the course of immigrant lives and also intergenerationally and into the children and the grandchildren of the immigrants. So we looked at things like education, occupation, income, poverty rates, and in all of those ways, immigrants are doing better over time and their children are doing better than the parents.
Over time, education levels match native-born Americans. Their incomes rise, and they have more diverse jobs. Waters says when immigrants arrive, they actually have some advantages.
So they are healthier, and they are more likely to live in families with two parents. They have lower divorce rates and lower childbirth out of wedlock. And also, immigrants are much less likely to commit crimes than native-born Americans.
Being less likely to commit crimes contradicts what some U.S. politicians say when speaking about immigration reform.
It's actually a long-standing stereotype in American society that immigrants commit more crimes than the native-born, and it's actually never been true for immigrants. If you look at young men aged 18 to 39 who are the most likely to commit crimes, the foreign-born are incarcerated at a rate that's one-fourth of the rate of the native-born.
The study also says U.S. cities that receive a lot of immigrants, including undocumented immigrants, generally see their crime rates fall. It says when immigrants first arrive, they're often healthier than native-born Americans. They're less likely to be smokers or obese. But the Harvard professor says things change.
Over time, their diet changes to be more like other Americans' diets, and we see a decline in their health, especially into the second and third generations.
And over generations, rates become more equal regarding crime and divorce as well.
On every measure that we looked at, immigrants are becoming more like the native-born.
As a result of immigration, one out of every seven marriages in the U.S. now crosses ethnic and racial lines. But at least one barrier remains.
One of the troubling things that we saw was that black immigrants were not having the same kind of residential integration as Asians and Latinos were. They were more likely to be in neighborhoods that had more black residents, so there was less integration there, and their intermarriage rates were also lower.
The study finds that U.S. record-keeping has not kept pace with immigration growth and diversity. It recommends, for example, that the census ask people if their parents were foreign-born. That would give a better picture of the long-term integration process. It also proposes a wider sharing of administrative data so the government can track income and education levels. The study did not take a position on the 11.6 million undocumented immigrants. Waters says that's a political issue. But she does say when parents are undocumented for many years, it has adverse effects on their children, both educationally and psychologically. What's more, Professor Waters says that birthright citizenship, gaining citizenship if born in the U.S., was one of the strongest underpinnings of a positive integration experience. Immigration is also having a major effect on the country. It's helping to slow the aging of the U.S. population. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
As the migrant and refugee crisis in Europe continues, EU leaders are looking beyond Europe's borders to help ease the crisis. The president of the European Union, Donald Tusk, says Europe needs to offer aid to Turkey and Balkan countries, which host more than 2 million Syrian refugees. He says the European bloc has so far failed dismally to meet the historic challenge of the crisis. Tusk adds that he may propose increased contributions to the UN World Food Program for an estimated 11 million people in Syria and the region. He also says he wants the EU to pursue diplomatic efforts to end the conflict in Syria. Mr. Tusk presides today over a Brussels meeting of European Union countries to ratify yesterday's vote to accept 120,000 migrants and to strengthen EU external borders. Also, President of the European Commission, Johannes Hahn, says member states are looking for more than $1 billion for a trust fund for Syrian refugees in Turkey. Of the estimated 500,000 migrants entering Europe this year, 40% are Syrians fleeing a 5-year civil war. Twenty past the hour, you were listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Cameroon has sealed more of its border with Nigeria amid repeated attacks in the past week by suspected Boko Haram militants. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Migyiyawa Bakari, governor of the far north region of Cameroon, says there have been 7 attacks in his region in less than a week, including 2 on Tuesday, when Cameroon soldiers killed at least 11 assailants in the town of Amchide and 2 female suicide bombers killed themselves in Mora. Cameroon's far north region shares a border with Nigeria's Borno State, the home turf of the Boko Haram insurgency, and there is concern that insurgent attacks could increase as Cameroonian Muslims prepare to celebrate Eid al-Adha Thursday, known locally as Tabaski.
Nous allons tout droit vers les fêtes de Tabaski. Il est donc urgent que nous doublons encore de vigilance.
Governor Migyiyawa says it is very important to double their vigilance on the eve of Tabaski when militants have traditionally increased attacks. He says it is thanks to the increased vigilance of the population and Cameroon's military that there have not been more attacks. But while closing the border may allow local residents to feel more secure, it also imposes an economic cost. Cattle and sheep trader Yayam Bule says the border closure has slowed economic activity. He says insecurity has led to a scarcity of rams and increased prices. But he says he cannot blame the government because peace has no price. He says he cannot risk his life to go buy and sell animals. Imam Ibrahim Aruna of Garua in northern Cameroon says the religious community is also taking precautions. He says they have doubled checkpoints at entry points of mosques and reduced the number of places where the faithful will come out to pray during Tabaski from 15 to 6. Boko Haram has stepped up attacks in Cameroon since the country started cracking down on the radical Islamist group. It has used Cameroon's far north as a base for recruitment and supplies for its Nigeria operations. Cameroon has reported at least 20 attacks on its territory this month, with a majority targeting markets, popular neighborhoods, and mosques. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
An estimated 2 million Muslim pilgrims from around the world climbed Mount Arafat today, completing the high point of the annual Hajj to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. Security has been tight for the event amid numerous regional threats, as Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
The pilgrims made their ritual climb up Mount Arafat amid searing heat on the second day of the annual Hajj. Saudi state TV showed the throngs winding their way to the Namira Mosque to hear a sermon by the country's top religious leader. The ritual is said to take place on the hillside where Islam's prophet Muhammad gave his final sermon. In a veiled reference to the Islamic State group, Grand Mufti Abdulaziz al-Sheikh told the gathering that Islam is being torn apart by those who distort what he says is its real message. He says Islam's enemies are spreading false messages and false beliefs, and they are heretics pretending to be Muslims but not part of the faith. Saudi Interior Ministry spokesman General Mansour bin Turki told journalists this year's pilgrimage has taken place without incident. He says there have been no acts of terrorism or destruction this year, and security forces have performed well in fending off such threats. Saudi commentator Jamal Khashoggi tells VOA that residents of Mecca have had hundreds of years of experience in hosting the Hajj and are now experts in making it a success. Khashoggi says Saudi officials have also tried in recent years to divorce Islam's highest religious ceremony from politics.
Saudi Arabia been sending the message to the Muslim world that keep politics off the Hajj. And it seems that this began to pay off. When you look at the Muslims now in Mecca, some of them come from regions that is in turmoil, but those people are not fighting in Mecca.
The pilgrims were to spend the night in the Valley of Muzdalifa after a slow descent down Mount Arafat. Thursday will mark the end of the annual Hajj as pilgrims sacrifice an animal in a rite said to date back to the prophet Abraham. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Republic of Congo President Denis Sassou Nguesso wants a change in the constitution so he can run for office again at the age of 71. The AP reports Mr. Sassou Nguesso has proposed a referendum that would approve raising the constitutional age limit for presidential candidates from 70 years of age before the next election. When his term ends next year, the president will have served more than 39 years as president. When he was first elected in 1979, he served 13 years. 5 years later, he seized power and in 2002 and 2009 was elected to consecutive 7-year terms. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, they need to have a native computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. The 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music.
No clouds in my stones.
Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 17:30 UTC on The Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. President Obama welcomed Pope Francis to the White House today with a formal outdoor ceremony. And immigration is a hot topic in the U.S. presidential race, and Pope Francis also says it's an important issue. And an estimated 2 million Muslim pilgrims from around the world climbed Mount Arafat today, completing the high point of the annual Hajj to Mecca. Coming up, music from Uganda. And in our feature segment, a conversation with one of Africa's best-known entrepreneurs, Noha Samara. I'm Yehi Suhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Your Highness.
What's on the sports menu for this evening, Douglas?
Well, Your Highness, we kick up with athletics. Thank you very much. The field at the Rock and Roll Vodafone RTP Half Marathon Championships is taking shape. The half marathon is an AAAF Gold Label Road Race that will take place in Lisbon on October 18th. Ethiopia's Mary Dibaba and Kenya's Bernard Koech will headline the event. As well as having the fastest half marathon personal best of the field with her 1 hour, 7 minutes and 13 seconds clocking from 2010, Dibaba also owns the fastest marathon personal best, having twice closed 2 hours, 19 minutes and 52 seconds. Dibaba will be up against fellow Ethiopian Tifis Gasegaye, winner of the Berlin and Tokyo marathons last year. Her last half marathon was in 2012 when she clocked a personal best of 1 hour, 7 minutes and 42 seconds in the Rome Ostia race. Wude Ayello, the 2009 World 10,000 meter bronze medalist, is also in the field. Her half marathon personal best of 1 hour, 7 minutes and 58 seconds was set on her debut at the distance back in 2009. Sara Moreira, the 2013 European Indoor 3,000-meter champion, leads the Portuguese entries. Koech owns a marathon personal best of 2 hours, 4 minutes, 53 seconds, and a half-marathon best of 58 minutes, 41 seconds. Although it was set on Santiago's downhill course, it still makes him the third fastest man in history under any conditions. Koech will line up against 2011 World 10,000-meter champion Ibrahim Jailen. The Ethiopian has contested the past two editions of this race, finishing 8th in 2014 and 11th in 2013. Alex Oliptiptip, who finished 4th in this race last year, is also in the field. The Kenyan recently set a half-marathon personal best of 59 minutes, 28 seconds in Copenhagen. The men's course record was set in 2013 by Wilson Kiprop, while the women's course record of 1 hour, 7 minutes and 54 seconds was set in 2011 by Mary Kaitani.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Join with leaders like President Sirleaf.
Malaria stops footballers from scoring and students from learning.
And join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
United, we can beat malaria.
In African football, semi-final action kicks off this coming weekend in the CAF Confederation Cup tournament. Our African football guru, David Legg, tells my colleague, Sane Young, he thinks it's the strongest Final Four in Confederation Cup history.
When you look at the lineup, sheepers, this is very strong indeed.
You have got Orlando Pirates of South Africa up against Al Ahly of Egypt, the title holders. And you've got Etoile Sahel of Tunisia up against Zamalek of Egypt. Now, the first thing you notice about those four clubs is all of them are previous African champions. That is an amazingly strong lineup. It is, to me, Sonny, the strongest lineup ever in the semifinals of the CAF Confederation Cup. And with the greatest of respect to the CAF Champions League, I believe that lineup is even stronger than the one for the CAF Champions League. The dream final, of course, as we've mentioned before on the Sunny Side of Sport, would be an Atli-Zamalek showdown. These are the two Egyptian giants. Atli are the most successful CAF club. They've won 19 titles, including 8 in the Champions League. And the second most successful club are Zamalek. They've won 9 titles. Incidentally, the third most successful club are Etoile Sahel with 8. So you have the first, second, and third most successful CAF clubs all playing in the second-tier competition. Now, of course, the million-dollar question, who's going to win those semifinals? Well, I think you have to, at this stage, go for the Egyptian clubs. They've both been very impressive. They're very good on the road. Zamalek, if anything, have been the more impressive of the two. In the final group game, Zamalek played Orlando Pirates of South Africa, and this was billed as a big one, a top-of-the-table clash. But for most of the match, there was only one side in it, and it certainly was not Orlando Pirates. Zamalek played some superb football. They won 4-1. Karaba, he scored one of the goals and created two others for Zamalek. And I'm not exaggerating when I say the final scoreline could have been 6 or 7-1 because Evono, the Equatorial Guinean goalkeeper who signed for Pirates recently, he made several superb saves. Pirates really were outclassed, and Zamalek, not only are they likely finalists, but at this stage I would say probably likely winners of the competition. In the other match in that group, which was academic interest only, AC Leopards of Congo Brazzaville and CS Faxien of Tunisia drew 0-0. So the final standings in that group, Sonny, were Zamalek 15 points, Pirates second with 12, Leopards a distant third with 5, and Faxien, record 3-time winners of the Confederation Cup, a really disappointing bottom place for them with just 2 points, 2 draws and 4 defeats. In the other group, Atli and Etoile Sahel, they were level going into the final round of matches. Both won, so they also finished level with 13 points each. And Atli finished first because of a superior goal difference. Etoile didn't look like they were going to win. They were trailing Esperance of Tunisia for a long time. And then Bounedjah, an Algerian and one of the deadliest finishers in African football at the moment, he scored 1 minute from time from a penalty spot. And then 3 minutes into stoppage time to snatch a 2-1 victory for the team known as the Red Devils, who are based in the Mediterranean resort of Sousse. For Atli, it was a 1-0 home victory over Stade Malien of Mali. Gamal, after 75 minutes, scoring the only goal. So just to confirm again, Sonny, those semi-finals, it'll be Pirates against Atli. That's a repeat of the 2013 CAF Champions League final won by the Egyptians. And Sahel of Tunisia up against Zamalek of Egypt. And I seem to be sticking my neck out a lot on the Voice of America this week. I'm going for an Atli-Zamalek final.
Our African football guru, David Legg, predicting an all-Egyptian final in the CAF Confederation Cup tournament. David was talking with my colleague, Sunny Young, from Johannesburg, South Africa. Now, here in New York City, many African migrants have brought their love of football to the city's grassroots leagues. Football is a way to hone sports skills prized in their African homelands, build community between groups of different national origins, and for the most talented, perhaps forge a path to financial success for oneself and one's family. VOA's Adam Phillips reports from New York.
It's late on a golden Sunday afternoon in Harlem, which is located on the northern part of Manhattan Island. The African Association League championship game between Mali in red jerseys and Burkina Faso in blue is underway. Boubacar Sarre, who emigrated from Mali just 8 months ago, is about to take the field.
I'm very happy to play.
to give my best for my team.
Does this remind you of home? Is there a lot of soccer, football at home?
Yes, a lot of soccer play at home. Sometimes I feel alone because my family live over there in Mali, so sometimes I miss them. I feel so alone, but when I play the soccer game, I feel better. I feel like $1 million.
But Sare says he's also grateful to be in America, challenges and all.
I go to school to meet many friends, and I learn English. That was my dream before, to come to the United States, and I can make money to support my family over there.
Abubakar Sako plays forward for the Burkina Faso team. He says he and some of his teammates hope one day to support their families through football, which is called soccer in the U.S. He keeps watch for talent scouts.
First of all, we got to work to support our family back in the country. And at the same time, our dream is to be a professional soccer player and play in the big team like Real Madrid or something like that. But we got to start from the bottom first and trying to join small team, even college. Because I play for a college team.
So that's a way of doing your passion, but doing it the American way, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Mali-born Amidou Haidera is president of the African Association League, which organized today's competition. He agrees that football or soccer is a promising pathway to success for some immigrants.
Well, I hope so, but you know, we're not doing it for, you know, to gain something out of it. We just like try to, you know, get people involved, you know, do a little exercise. That's it. Get together, get to know each other. That's the most important thing, you know. I'm from Mali. As you can see, like Mali is playing against Burkina. There's Ivory Coast, it was participating. Senegal, Guinea, you know, Sierra Leone, there was other teams, you know. It's not only Mali, just like the whole African nations. We all one family, big family, happy family, you know. We do things together, you know. It's about community, the whole community, not Mali, but the whole African community.
Saka Bagayan coaches the Burkina Faso team. He says he gets community building lessons from the sport that can also help him off the field.
For instance, I'm in financial services, and I learned about leadership by being here and leading these guys. And it's very difficult to lead these guys. And I learned a lot of patience, empathy, and which is great. And I take it to my career.
And what do they think they're learning?
I think they're learning to be part of a team, to be a team player, this guy. And they're also learning to accept each other, which is valuable. They take it within, similarly to their job.
Mohamed Touré, another coach, says that camaraderie and community are already familiar features of many African cultures. In contrast, he says, American culture generally takes an every man for himself approach in work and in play.
Yes, everybody depends on about yourself. Back home, it's not like this. You know, then making sure you know everybody okay. Player, somebody got injured, then everybody have to collect money, then give it to that person. We are, you know, try to have a family.
Philosophy aside, the game continued. And while neither team scored, Mali took the trophy for winning more games than other teams in the league during the 2015 season. To judge by the ready handshakes and easy laughter between players at the end, the league's common goal of camaraderie, fellowship, and sport was achieved. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is VOA's Adam Phillips in New York.
Thanks, Adam. And that's all the time we have for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Simpoga. Sunny Young will be back tomorrow. Now back to Yahayas.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, a conversation with one of Africa's best-known entrepreneurs, Noha Samara. And next, the pressure of living and working in the diaspora. But first, some music. Here is George Okodi and Josephina Tanga from Uganda with Celebrate Africa.
Africa, a beautiful people united in a rainbow color, a people with a culture that never grows weary. So let's be united
George Okudi and Joseph Natanga from Uganda would celebrate Africa. One of Africa's best-known entrepreneurs is Noah Samara, the chairman and CEO of Yasmi USA. The company manufactures the Odyssey tablet for schools in rural, low-income, and remote areas of the world. It relies on satellites instead of the internet to reach students with curricular and software tools for learning and teaching. With the solar-charged tablet, students can participate in live classrooms from home. Samara was also the chief executive officer of WorldSpace, the world's first operating satellite radio network that serves Africa, Asia, and the Middle East. I spoke to Samara recently about his career and the use of technology in education. In today's segment, I asked Samara about his latest venture, the Yasmi system, and a pilot project he started in Ethiopia.
The Yasmi system consists of a satellite network, a tablet, a server that sits in a school and creates a Wi-Fi connectivity and provides continuous satellite updates to the tablets and the devices that students are using, and a solar power charger for places where electricity is non-existent, and content. So we had put all of the pieces together, and finally at the e-learning conference in Ethiopia this year, we went to the principal of St. Joseph, which was the high school I went to. So we went to him and we suggested a pilot, but we wanted to do the pilot in a very highly measured kind of way. We wanted to measure outcome. We wanted to see whether there was a difference between students who used this tablet and students who didn't. So we crafted the design of the pilot itself in a very careful way. We took the syllabus that St. Joseph follows, which is the Ethiopian syllabus, which is generally a very two-dimensional kind of syllabus, textbooks that talk about cell division for biology and the atom for physics and, you know, math and reading and chemistry. And we took that sort of textbook, two-dimensional content, went to content makers, and we said, following this syllabus, lesson by lesson, we want you to give us the best content that explains that concept from the best content that can be found. So they went on and they took each lesson, amplified each lesson, and reduced it into a video content that summarized that lesson in, you know, several minutes. So the way the program would begin is at each lesson, the teacher would get content that is specialized, that teaches the teacher how to best and most effectively teach that particular lesson to the classroom. Then the teacher teaches based upon the learning experience, teaches for the first 30 minutes or so, or 35 minutes of the class. Then the video is played as a reinforcer to what the students have just learned. And then after that, there is an assessment that occurs so that they self-test, and that assessment automatically goes to a server. So this was the design of the program, to make sure that the content is effective and exciting and well-organized.
That was Ethiopian entrepreneur Noah Samara. He spoke to me recently from our VOA studios in Washington. The pressure of living and working in the diaspora is too much for some who moved from their home countries but never found the so-called milk and honey. Death by suicide among foreigners has been recorded for a long time now. Dr. Ian Ndolvu is a special worker and a Zimbabwean living in the United Kingdom. He told reporter Gibbs Dube that cases of suicide among Zimbabweans appear to be on the rise in various countries.
In the UK, among the people from, let's say, from Zimbabwe, what we've heard is a number of cases where people have committed suicide. It depends on the age group. For the younger ones, it's usually to do with bullying, to do it with pressure from many angles in their lives. With much older people, most of them, it comes up as depression. In an African context, we don't have a definition of what a depressed person is like. But in the UK, when people are thinking about what they are going to do, where they've been, they go into what we call depression, and usually you find them committing suicide.
So now, how prevalent can we say this is in the UK and most probably some other countries where Zimbabweans are living?
It's prevalent amongst many groups. I don't have the actual figures how prevalent it is, but it does happen in the UK as well. It could be that most of us who have come from the African countries have experienced a culture change, especially for our children. They try to be involved, identify with the local culture, and some of them get into things that as parents we don't accept as a community or as people from Africa or let's say Zimbabwe wouldn't accept those things. And then there is that disconnect with our roots, and the people feel, you know, left out, or they feel they are outcast, and then they go down the depression route and they commit suicide.
You are a social worker, and people may expect maybe for you to give them advice on, you know, how to avoid some of these issues, especially let's go to bullying. How do you actually tackle that?
You have to have a good relationship with your child. Make sure your child can come to you and say, I'm being bullied in school. And once you see any signs that your child is worried about going to school, you need to take it up with the local authorities or the school authorities. Because if you don't, your child will be bullied and won't tell you, because the bullies actually intimidate them and say, if you tell someone, it's going to be worse. So in order to keep the peace, your child won't tell you what's going on. But your child should have a good relationship with you and believe that my father or my mother can do anything. No one can beat my mother. No one can beat my father. And then you have a good relationship with your child. Then you can help them deal with bullying in school.
In terms of depression, Dr. Ndlovu, what could be the best measures of correcting that?
The first port of call is the doctor. In the UK, everyone has got a doctor. They are registered to the GP. If you feel you are worried, you are anxious, anxiety, and all the kind of stuff, thinking about yourself, thinking, having these suicidal thoughts, go to the doctor and explain what's going on in your life, and then you'll get medication, and then you can be stable on medication.
Now, on the issue of people that are taking substances like cocaine and so forth, What should be done there?
There is a service in the UK called the Drug and Alcohol Service. People go there and work with them, and some of them get onto methadone reduction programs, which help them to get off the drugs. But the key issue is that while working with the Drug and Alcohol Service, one needs to cut off ties with the friends, the environment that would lead them to relapse.
What do you think could be the solution to some of the people that face this kind of ethnic disintegration?
There is a need to have a connection with your roots by talking to people from your country, meeting them at their homes, sharing small things like food from Africa just to revive the memories, the songs from Africa.
Thank you. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Ofor, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes. Thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya, most recently at a college in the town of Garissa. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of six of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Muhammad Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982, and Mukhtar Robo, a 43-year-old who has served as an al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of two additional al-Shabaab leaders, Abdullahi Yare and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersi, also known as Zaki Madobi. The United States guarantees all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, President Obama welcomes Pope Francis to Washington, D.C. His Holiness' visit to the U.S. comes ahead of his trip to Africa in November. We'll discuss the significance of the Pope's travel next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa. That's next time on VOA Africa. Yeah.